hijacking commercial planes and crashing them into the World Trade Center in New York City. The officials had helped the hijackers travel, reside, study, and even receive driving education in the U.S. 15 out of 19 people who carried out the 9/11 attacks were Saudi citizens. But for everyone, especially the families of the victims, it was very strange that what made different American administrations, from Democrat to Republican, act so cautiously in this regard. Years on, those families, as well as journalists and observers, are still confused about such stance. It seems strange for everyone that where this bond began and how it grew that has granted such immunity to Saudi Arabia, whose relationship still continues with the U.S. despite the fact that thousands of Americans were killed in the 9/11 attacks. Circle of extremist Wahhabi youths were formed during these years who could not withstand all these changes. In their view, the social situation in Saudi Arabia was very different from what it was during the beginning years of the creation of the country. And this way, a group that was cohesive and serious to counter these changes was formed under the leadership of a young man called Juhayman al-Utaybi. Several hundreds of people, along with Juhayman, occupied the sacred mosque on the first day of the lunar month of Muharram in 1400 AH to show that they would not tolerate the changes. They wanted to save Saudi Arabia from the wrong path it was taking, and therefore they took on a promising expression on their faces. Juhayman and his followers put up a strong resistance to the extent that Saudi Arabia appealed to French special forces for help. The occupation of the sacred mosque came to an end after 14 days and following bloody clashes between the two sides. More than 100,000 Soviet armed forces invaded Afghanistan at midnight of December the 27th, 1979, to support the government formed by People's Democratic Party of Afghanistan. 2 years into its formation, the Afghan government was engaged in a civil war following an uprising over its plans to change the social and religious structures of the country. Then U.S. President Jimmy Carter quickly issued a decree ordering a covert operation by the CIA to send arms to Afghan fighters from across the world. The Central Intelligence Agency, CIA, quickly appointed a team to provide all kinds of support to Afghan Mujahideen, and Pakistan was chosen as the nearest venue to organize, equip, and train them. Then Pakistani President Muhammad Zia-ul-Haq entered the operation in the hope of receiving military and financial assistance, as well as finding a strategic role in the region. Therefore, a mounting propaganda campaign against the Soviets' occupation of Afghanistan was launched across the world, especially in Islamic countries, to accelerate the process to recruit youths and dispatch them to Afghanistan. More than 35,000 people from 43 countries in the Middle East, North and East Asia, Central Asia, Far East and North Africa pledged allegiance to Afghan Mujahideen, and at least 20,000 of them went to Afghanistan to fight there. Among the young people who eagerly came to Afghanistan and Pakistan was a person named Osama bin Laden. He was from a prominent family that was highly influential due to its construction companies and close ties with the royal family in Saudi Arabia. Osama bin Laden met with Abdullah Azam, who was in charge of organizing migrant youths, and Osama was already acquainted with him in Saudi Arabia. After forming Bayt al-Ansar in 1984, that was one of the most important jihadi groups in Afghanistan, Osama, by 1986, established six more bases for the youth coming there from other countries to organize and direct them. Strikes by the Afghan groups against the invading forces were highly effective. The war, leaving heavy casualties, finally forced Soviet troops to leave Afghanistan. The last batch of them left the country on February 15, 1989. Meanwhile, a group that took a different path was Arab Afghans, those young people who had come to Afghanistan from across the world to help people there in the face of the occupation of their country. Since the majority of them were Arabs, they were called Arab Afghans. The rest decided to continue the path of fighting in different parts of the world. Their leader, Abdullah Azam, intended to transfer his forces to Palestine to continue jihad there after the occupation of Afghanistan ended. But Azam, along with his two sons, was killed in a suspicious bomb attack in Pakistan's city of Peshawar in 1989. It was in the early days of Osama's return to Saudi Arabia when everyone was shocked by an incident. Then Iraqi ruler Saddam Hussein invaded the country's small and rich neighbor Kuwait, advancing near the town of Al-Khafij on the border with Saudi Arabia. Osama, who had ties with the Saudi royal family, proposed that thousands of his forces be used for battles against Saddam to drive out the Ba'ath army from Kuwait. Osama believed that non-Muslim armies should not enter Islamic countries, especially Saudi Arabia, at a time when thousands of fresh fighters already defeating the invading Soviet army are able to fight Saddam's army. Saudi princes opposed Osama's proposal, probably because they were not hopeful that it would be practical, or they did not want him to turn into a national hero in this battle. A coalition led by the U.S. was formed to drive out Saddam from Kuwait. Such a coalition had not previously been formed in any war. The opposition of Saudi officials to Osama bin Laden's plan angered him, and it was the beginning of a direct fight against the interests of the U.S. and its Arab allies, including Saudi Arabia. That was because Osama considered Arab leaders as being completely controlled by the U.S., and he decided to target the U.S. with his attacks. The beginning of the 1990s marked a new era for Osama and his followers as they felt that they had been betrayed by everyone and that they should find a new way. Attacking U.S. interests in different parts of the world was top of the agenda of his organization called Al-Qaeda. The manpower required to do the job had been trained with the help of the U.S. and Saudi Arabia years before and was present in all parts of the world following the Afghanistan war and was now ready to carry out the attacks. During these years, Osama lived in Sudan for a while, where he did business and carried out economic and development activities. Under pressure by Saudi Arabia, Osama returned to Afghanistan in 1996 with his former friends. At this time, the Taliban were in control of large parts of Afghanistan and were practically the indisputable ruler of the country. Finally, the September 11 arrived, and the storm that the U.S. had launched in Afghanistan years before returned home. According to the official account given by the George W. Bush administration, 19 people, 15 of them Saudi nationals, boarded U.S. Airlines passenger planes. In a few minutes, they hijacked the planes and attacked a number of key U.S. buildings, including the World Trade Center. Now, the talk of the town was Al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden and the Taliban who had sheltered him in Afghanistan. The shock caused by the 9/11 attacks and the extensive media coverage of them was so high that prevented everyone, especially the Americans, from thinking about this question, that how was it possible for people in another part of the world, in a devastated country like Afghanistan, to plan such an operation and train individuals for it? In the days that followed the 9/11 attacks, several private jets were assigned with withdrawing a group of Saudi families from the U.S. They included 24 people from the bin Laden family who were withdrawn without being investigated and left the U.S. to avoid being attacked by angry Americans. The U.S. asked the Taliban to hand over Osama. They rejected the request and the U.S. quickly prepared to invade Afghanistan. A war quickly began and Afghanistan was occupied again, this time by the U.S. New bombs were dropped on the ruins left from two decades of war. After the 9/11 attacks, a commission headed by Bob Graham was formed to launch an inquiry into U.S. intelligence community activities. The commission investigated the activities of the CIA and the FBI from February 2002 until December that year. It released an 832-page report on the inquiry, of which 28 pages were classified.
Former U.S. Senator Bob Graham has been trying to get the 28 pages released since the day they were classified back in 2003, when he played a major role in the first government investigation into 9/11.
Those 28 pages were about a foreign state's involvement in the 9/11 attacks and its financial and logistical help to the hijackers. That pits the families of the victims of the attacks, as well as many journalists and politicians, against the Bush administration. They voiced their objection to the classification of those 28 pages in the following years, but to no avail, and the pages remained in secrecy.
Proudly, deliberately using his full name, Barack Hussein Obama, he became the 44th president of the United States.
Finally, the tenure of President George W. Bush ended, and the new president entered the White House. Barack Obama, despite facing pressure to declassify the pages, also refused to do so, partly because of Saudi threats to sell $750 billion in U.S. assets.
Today, Congress gave families of 9/11 victims the right to sue Saudi Arabia on the theory.
Less than 5 months before the end of his presidency, the Obama administration published a full report on the congressional inquiry into the 9/11 attacks, although many parts of it were still covered in black. According to these 28 pages, two of the hijackers named Khalid al-Mizhar and Nawaf al-Hazmi had close ties with Osama Basnan and Omar al-Bayoumi. Basnan and al-Bayoumi had ties with the Saudi embassy and Ambassador Bandar bin Sultan, the key man in U.S.-Saudi relations, and they received salaries from Saudi company Dar al-Arkan without having a job there. The two hijackers, since their arrival in the U.S. until several weeks before the attacks, were provided with services by the group linked with the Saudi embassy. Another issue that the 28-page part of the report had raised was the transfer of money by Saudi charity organizations based in the U.S. and Europe to suspects of terrorist activities. The inquiry by the 9/11 Commission emphasized that Saudi Arabia had long funded the Al-Qaeda group through its wealthy citizens and charity organizations that enjoyed high financial support. Despite that, the inquiry concluded that there is no evidence that the Saudi government as an institution or senior Saudi individuals funded Al-Qaeda. Maybe the best answer to this question has been given by Bandar bin Sultan, the former Saudi ambassador to the U.S.
We don't have taxes in the kingdom. People don't pay taxes. However, we have a religious tax that's dictated by our religion. And it is supposed to go to the poor. If you cannot find anybody needy, you go to the next neighborhood, or the next village, or the next city, or the next country. Well, in Saudi Arabia, God blessed us with a lot of wealth. We take care of almost all our people. So we send it to Afghanistan, to Bosnia, to Senegal, to anywhere in the world, to Africa, Asia, my point, the Arab world, as charities.
But the reality was that those amounts of money were mostly used to build schools and mosques that spread the Wahhabi thinking in the world and led to the formation of groups such as Al-Qaeda and their new form, Daesh. The most controversial news in this regard came out while the U.S. was in the process of passing the Justice Against Sponsors of Terrorism Act, known as JASTA.
The bill passed the Senate and was aimed at allowing families of the 9/11 victims to sue the Saudi government and enabling them to ask for tens of billions of dollars in damage if their case went ahead. Controversy arose after the New York Times revealed that, quote-unquote, senior White House officials had contacted members of Congress demanding that they reject JASTA. The officials had cited threats by Saudi Arabia to sell $750 billion in assets in case that law is implemented.
On Wednesday, Congress overwhelmingly voted to override President Barack Obama's veto of the Justice Against Sponsors of Terrorism Act, also known as JASTA, which would allow Americans to potentially sue Saudi Arabia for the 9/11 attacks.
U.S. District Judge George Daniels in Manhattan, who rejected the lawsuit filed by the families of the 9/11 victims, said Saudi Arabia had sovereign immunity from damage claims by them. The status means that sovereign governments are immune from lawsuits in U.S. courts. Despite all the indications, Judge Daniels issued a weird ruling on May the 1st of 2018.
A federal judge is ordering Iran to pay billions of dollars to the families of the victims of the attacks of 9/11.
Iran should pay $10.5 billion in damage to the families of the 9/11 victims and several insurers over what the U.S. federal judge called its role in the attacks. That ruling was not taken seriously even in the U.S. Maybe Saudi officials' direct link with the 9/11 attacks cannot be exactly found, and perhaps it's basically wrong to find such a link in a 28-page report and its covered lines. The reality of this story is the whole history of Saudi Arabia, where people in schools have been taught hatred for more than 100 years now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
In Britain, supporters of Liz Truss have said her key rival Penny Mordaunt has topped out of backers as the Foreign Secretary gained ground in the fight for second place in the Conservative leadership contest. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnists Jessica Elgott, Aubrey Allegretti and Peter Walker. The piece is titled Truss Camp Says Mordaunt Has Topped Out, with Tugendhat Latest to Fall. In Britain, supporters of Liz Truss have said her key rival Penny Mordaunt has topped out of backers, as the Foreign Secretary gained ground in the fight for second place in the Conservative leadership contest. Penny Mordaunt lost the vote in the latest ballot of Tory MPs, a key sign her campaign had stalled after a weekend of bruising attacks, but remained behind frontrunner Rishi Sunak. But the pressure is still on Liz Truss, who gained just 7 MP backers, less than the fourth place Kemi Badenoch, who received 9 new supporters. Tom Tugendhat, the chair of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee, was knocked out of the race. James Cleverly, the Education Secretary, said Liz Truss had shown during the leadership debates that she was ready for the job. This is about day one competence. She's showing she has always had the best depth and best breadth of experience, he added. The remaining leadership hopefuls will now be hoping to pick off Tom Tugendhat's 31 supporters. A Liz Truss backer said that Mordaunt's support was strong, but they believe she and Badenoch would not ultimately be able to overcome their relative lack of experience to win the chance to face off with Rishi Sunak in the final two. Sunak launched a crime policy blitz on Tuesday, 19th of July, pledging to introduce a new offence for belonging to or facilitating abuse by grooming gangs, as well as a new offence for taking so-called down-blousing pictures. He also proposed making it an aggravating factor in sentencing if criminals refuse to appear in court, and review sentence guidelines for crimes against women and girls. In his final pitch, the Tory MPs Tom Tugendhat used his speech to warn that the party was on the brink of a 1997-style wipeout in the next general election. The country is looking for a change, looking for a break from the past, and if we can't deliver that change, then Labour will, he warned MPs at the Closed Doors 1922 committee hustings. The threat we face is existential, he said. Tugendhat added, the public no longer believes us. We wouldn't be having this leadership race. We wouldn't be so behind in the polls if we had not lost the British people's faith. The MP said he had been offered jobs in future administrations if he dropped out of the race, but he wanted to see party democracy run its course. It's not my job to decide. It is yours, he told MPs. That is the nature of democracy, that I give you the choice rather than taking it from you. I have deplored the infighting, the sniping, the blue on blue, the attacks and the smears. We do not need this now or ever, he added. Tom Tugendhat's defeat meant that 4 remaining candidates turned attention away from fighting for survival and instead to the final 2 ballots of Tory MPs. Candidates will be specially keen to court the Tugendhat backers, Jake Berry and Anne-Marie Trevelyan, key endorsements from the Northern Research Group caucus of Red Wall Tories. Anne-Marie Trevelyan, the International Trade Secretary, has been critical of Penny Mordaunt's time in her department. Understandably, perhaps, now it's clear, Penny has for the last few months spent some of her time focused on preparing her leadership campaign, for which I have utmost respect. That's how this system works, Trevelyan told LBC. There have been a number of times when she hasn't been available, which would have been useful, and other ministers have picked up the pieces, she added. Rishi Sunak gained 14 supporters from the last ballot to put him on a total of 115, trailed by Penny Mordaunt, who lost 1 supporter, giving her a total of 82. Liz Truss remained in third place, picking up 7 supporters to put her on 71. Kemi Badenoch came fourth with an extra 9 supporters, giving her a total of 58. As the race narrowed, MPs said Badenoch and Mordaunt were most likely to benefit from a tussle between the factions trying to keep Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss from making the final 2. Though Sunak retained a relatively comfortable position as frontrunner, his team was still set to be furiously ringing around wavering MPs. I don't think he's going to have that massive majority where he can go to the country and be the dominating candidate, said one Tugendhat supporter, who said they were likely to support Liz Truss after Monday's vote. That's going to undermine his position, because as a former chancellor, for him to go on level pegging, that's damning. Another Tugendhat backer said, Rishi's people are worried. They should be clear. They shouldn't be worried about MP numbers, but they are trying to grab us quite hard. They should be shaping who's against rather than bolstering his own numbers. Some of the ousted MP supporters said they would meet after a vote for a commiseration drink and discuss with each other who to back. Several talked up the prospect of supporting Penny Mordaunt as the change candidate. The final three candidates, after the next round of voting takes place at mid-afternoon on Tuesday, 19th of July, had been expected to appear at a third television debate hosted by Sky News. But the debate was cancelled after Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss pulled out of the event after a bruising set of exchanges in the first two debates. Earlier, a source in Rishi Sunak's campaign said the former chancellor had never committed to participating in the debate, adding, "We're very happy to do more debates if we're lucky enough to get to the next stage, including Sky News." Liz Truss's aides had said the foreign secretary was unlikely to take part if all the other candidates did not. The cancellation follows sometimes brutal exchanges in television debates on Friday and Sunday over taxation plans and about social issues. While Rishi Sunak has faced the brunt of the attacks on the former subject, Penny Mordaunt has been repeatedly criticised for supposedly being too liberal. After Sky News cancelled the debate, a spokesperson for Penny Mordaunt said, "It's a shame some colleagues cannot find a way to debate one another in a civil way." That quote was later deleted, with the spokesperson instead saying the candidate hopes there will be ample opportunity for such scrutiny later on in the contest. Conservative MPs voted against a confidence motion in the government on Monday evening, 18th of July, with several giving speeches praising Boris Johnson.
Hidden Files. Well, for us Americans, the U.S. invasion of Iraq was set like an elaborate game. U.S. forces were to bravely buckle up and eliminate the enemies of democracy in Iraq. Propaganda was pouring in from all sides about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction and more. And Americans were encouraged to cheer on the forces as we joined them in spirit, thousands of miles away in nearly everything we did, even in the games we played, games such as the Iraqi Most Wanted card game, which was promoted back then in 2003. Well, these cards were officially named personality identification playing cards and had on them the pictures of the Iraqi regime officials that the U.S. military was aiming to heroically eliminate. And by the way, these figures include some whom had formerly been put in place and supported by the U.S., but that's a story for another day. Of course, as those of us familiar with politics and propaganda could already predict years later, it was discovered that not only was Iraq void of WMDs, but in reality, it was the American forces which were a threat to Iraqis, not the other way around. Then we read about secret American prisons and all kinds of unbelievable torture methods. And so, as a result of these crimes, a person continues to serve time in prison. Strangely enough, that person is not any of those who initiated the offensive on Iraq. Instead, he's the man behind exposing American crimes in places like Iraq and Afghanistan and Guantanamo Bay, a whistleblower called Julian Assange. Welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi. And now let's take a look at what this is really all about and who is Julian Assange.
Julian Assange is a 51-year-old journalist from Australia, a computer expert and publisher who wanted to give access to whistleblowers to share their information. In December 2006, he publishes the first WikiLeaks cable on the site. On April 5, 2010, WikiLeaks releases the collateral damage of Iraq. In July 2010, the Afghanistan papers. In August 2010, Sweden files a sexual misconduct case against Assange. On October 22, 2010, WikiLeaks releases the Iraq war logs, documenting the U.S. invasion and occupation of the country. On June 19, 2012, Assange enters the Ecuadorian embassy in London to avoid arrest. In August 2012, Ecuador grants him citizenship based on political asylum, but the U.K. will arrest him if he leaves the embassy to travel to Ecuador. In May 2017, Sweden drops the charges. On April 11, 2019, he is forcibly removed from the embassy and sent to the high-security Belmarsh prison in the UK, where he has been since. On May 23, 2019, the US charges Assange with 17 counts of espionage. In total, Assange has 18 charges against him in the U.S. and could face 175 years in prison. Currently, Assange is still fighting extradition to the United States. In total, Assange spent 7 years in the Ecuadorian embassy in London and now has spent 3 years in Belmarsh prison.
Only in WikiLeaks' release of Iraq war documents, 391,832 United States Army field reports were exposed. Now, these Iraq war logs were from 2004 to 2009 and published on the Internet on October the 22nd, 2010. Well, the files record 66,081 civilian deaths out of 109,000 recorded deaths. Now, this means over 60% of the deaths, I repeat, 60% of the deaths recorded were civilians. Well, one would think that after the publishing of these documents, some of those responsible for such war crimes would be held accountable, perhaps made to pay a fine to the families of the victims or sentenced to time in prison. Unfortunately, the reality could be nothing further from the truth. And even one of the leaders of that fabricated Western war against Iraq, former British Prime Minister Tony Blair, is even said to be knighted by the Queen. So in this world where values seem to be upside down, wouldn't you know it that it is Assange, the whistleblower, who ended up being investigated, tracked down, and incarcerated. Assange is paying the price for exposing the crimes, but the criminals who committed the crimes continue to walk free and in some instances are hailed as heroes. And Assange is facing possible extradition to the United States and a 175 years prison sentence, if that's possible. Well, stay with us as we look a little closer at all of this with our first guest.
Dr. Deepa Govindarajan Driver. She has served 3 years as a legal observer in the case of Julian Assange. She is a trade unionist and is interested in state and corporate accountability, as well as the protection of whistleblowers. Dr. Driver teaches governance, compliance, risk management, and regulation.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Driver. Now, you have been an observer for more than 3 years at the Julian Assange trial. Why have you been in court during that time?
Thanks for asking the question. About 3.5 years ago, I started to monitor this case on behalf of the and through the process on behalf of the Haldane Society of Socialist Lawyers and the ALDH. Because I think this case is really important for ordinary people, people like you and me and people in your audience, who want to know, who want to understand what's happening behind closed doors. As an academic, I study whistleblowing and governance. And whether it's a care home where an elderly relative is being mistreated, or whether it's a prison where somebody's being harmed, or whether it's climate justice and dumping toxic waste, or whether it is war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan and elsewhere. The only way we know about what really happens behind closed doors is through the courage of whistleblowers.
Well, what message do you think the U.S. is trying to give to journalists and others with the Assange case?
It was very, very courageous in the way it stood up to the world's greatest superpower, that is America, when they said, you know, you have all this evidence. It is accurate. Nobody was able to challenge its accuracy, whether it was torture at Guantanamo or war crimes in Iraq or the Americans putting pressure on the Germans not to allow Khaled El-Masri's case to come to trial. You know, he was this German citizen who was indicted, sodomized, tortured, and then they found it was a case of mistaken identity. So this kind of information only came into the public domain in a way in which the Americans couldn't deny it, thanks to WikiLeaks. And then you have the situation where the Americans then said to WikiLeaks, hang on a second, you're not allowed to share this because it shows our criminality and the criminality of our allies. Firstly, Assange is not a U.S. citizen. He didn't carry out any of his journalism in the U.S. either. He's a non-U.S. citizen carrying out serious journalism about U.S. war crimes abroad. And the U.S. is trying to use the Espionage Act, which is an act that was created in 1917, I believe, or thereabouts, and which is highly contested, which is not seen as a very benign act, especially now. And its use against a journalist is deeply troubling because, you know, to classify journalism as espionage is deeply worrying. But what is also worrying is the fact that instead of the people who tortured the 789 Muslim men in Guantanamo being on trial, we now have Julian Assange being silenced in Belmarsh. And that sends a message to journalists. It says, tomorrow, if you were to receive a whistleblower telling you, here's another Guantanamo happening, and you're not a journalist sitting in the U.S., you're somewhere else in the world, will you disclose those war crimes, knowing that the United States has extradition treaties with various countries? So this is not going to, you know, a lot of people say, oh, this is going to set a chilling precedent for journalism if Julian's extradited. But the chilling precedent has already been set. Nobody, no journalist, is safe now. And we need to stop this right now.
Yeah, indeed. It's so troubling. Dr. Driver, I want to look at Britain's role in all of this because, as you know, the Home Secretary has recently given the okay for Assange to be extradited. Your take on that side of things?
Well, you're absolutely right. You know, here is a peaceful man, an intellectual, one of the intellectual giants of our time, one of the greatest political prisoners of our time, being held in a maximum security prison because Britain is hugely complicit in a lot of this torture and this criminality abroad. The Home Secretary's decision reflects a sentiment that seems to permeate through the British system and the British establishment, which is a certain willful blindness to what is being done to Assange. What's interesting is that now establishment actors like David Davis, the Conservative MP, the senior Conservative MP, a lot of human rights organizations, whether it's Amnesty or Human Rights Watch, press freedom organizations all around the world, including the IFJ, the Porte Sans Frontier, and others, have all come out and condemned this. And the Council of Europe's human rights expert has also condemned this, as has the UN's rapporteur on torture. So the UK is really behaving like a rogue state. And it was very obvious what they had done when they extracted Mr. Assange from the embassy. Because when they did that, Mr. Assange was in asylum. He was an Ecuadorian citizen. Now, no matter what kinds of deals you have, extraditing him, pulling him out of that embassy without giving him due process, without revoking his citizenship, without revoking his asylum through the full court process, is in itself a breach of the basics of, international cooperation. And so the US, the UK, Alan Duncan, the MP, the former MP, has admitted to organizing this extraction from the embassy in collusion with Ecuador and the US. So this is not a standard process. This is not Britain upholding the rule of law. In fact, Britain has shamed itself yet again in terms of the rule of law.
Well, where does everything stand now with the Home Secretary giving the okay for him to be extradited? What's next for Assange's legal team?
Well, there's a number of different things. One is when domestic remedies are exhausted, then you can go to the European Court of Human Rights. And on the factor, which is the assurances, these absolutely hollow assurances that the US gave that maybe they won't torture him if they decide when he gets there that he hasn't done anything that merits torture, in effect. That's the nature of the assurances they have given. It's laughable. So on that count, that presumably will go through the European Court of Human Rights process. There is also an appeal against Priti Patel's decision, which has to go through the process. And lastly, and most importantly, Julian Assange won his case against extradition at the Magistrates Court. So he won basically in relation to the health conditions and the US prison conditions, right? So many of the other conditions that he lost on, whether it was questions in relation to press freedom, democracy, the extraterritorial rights of the US, the ability to extradite a journalist, were not actually debated, because then you had the US appeal and all you could talk about were the grounds for the US appeal. So now Julian's lawyers will launch something called a cross appeal, which contests all those grounds that he lost at the Magistrates Court, and then that will go through to the Court of Appeal and then presumably to the Supreme Court if there are points of law that need to be agreed. So the process will continue. The way whistleblowers and journalists are treated is very evident. The way America has zero respect for international law is evident through the fact that Guantanamo is still open 20 years after it was, set up. And we know from the fact that the United States has been able to charge only a handful of people at Guantanamo that a lot of innocent people were tortured, abducted, raped, sodomized at the behest of America, all the while America is telling the world, oh, we care about human rights, we care about press freedom, we care about democracy.
It's absolutely unbelievable. We thank you so much for being with us, Dr. Driver, right here at Hidden Files. Well, as you've just heard, Julian Assange has been subjected to so many injustices. He has been deprived of sunlight for practically 10 years now. And while he was at the Ecuadorian embassy for those 7 years, Assange was also spied upon by the CIA, who watched and listened to him through embassy CCTV, even while he was having confidential meetings with his lawyer. And in 2017, when Mike Pompeo was the head of the CIA, his agency planned to kidnap or kill Assange. Now, American officials were embarrassed because WikiLeaks had published Vault 7, a set of CIA hacking tools. And in that same year, Pompeo named WikiLeaks as a non-state hostile intelligence service. basically given the agency the green light to do whatever it could to contain or eliminate Assange. Well, let's cross over to our next guest right now.
John Kiriakou. He's a former CIA officer. He had a top-secret, sensitive security clearance. Kiriakou turned whistleblower against CIA crimes. In 2012, he became the first CIA officer to be convicted of passing on classified information to a reporter. Kiriakou is also an author and has been a TV consultant.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, John. Pleasure to have you. I want to talk about the price that whistleblowers have to pay for exposing the truth.
That's a good question and an important one. It's hard to be a whistleblower. The price is quite high. You will give up your life as you know it. You'll be unemployable. In many cases, your friends walk away from you. In many cases, your family walks away from you. You'll never have, at least in my case, I'll never have a security clearance again. I'll never be able to get a job in corporate America. I'm radioactive. I've had friends tell me privately that they support me, they're pulling for me, but they're very sorry they can't be seen in public with me. I had one friend and former colleague who sent a middleman to my house to shake my hand when I got home from prison, to say welcome home, and that he hoped I understood that we could never speak to each other again. So this is quite common. And on top of all that, you have to consider the legal expenses. In my case, I ran up legal bills of $1,150,000, bills that I will never be able to pay. Julian's bills so far have been more like $5 or $6 million. And so, you know, it's one of these things where the goal isn't even necessarily to win in court and to incarcerate you. It's to ruin you so you can never make a comeback. And then more importantly, it's to frighten anybody else who's thinking of blowing the whistle on waste, fraud, abuse, or illegality so that they keep their mouths shut.
That's absolutely mind-boggling, John. I mean, what do you make of all of this? Your take on actually those who are innocent are the ones who end up paying the price, and those who are guilty seem to get off.
Yeah, you know, on the first day of employment, for every employee of the federal government, you put your right hand up in the air and you swear to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Well, I took that oath very seriously. And to me, in my case, I blew the whistle on the CIA's torture program. I believed that the torture program was illegal in addition to being immoral and unethical. And I thought certainly others believe as I do, certainly somebody will say something. And nobody did. And finally, it got so bad that the White House was denying that there was a torture. They were denying that there were secret prisons. They were denying that there was a rendition program. And I just couldn't remain silent any longer. You know, a crime is a crime is a crime. And the American people have the right to know what their government is doing in their name. And so I went public. In Julian's case, it was very similar, where you can dislike the fact that he released millions of pages of documents, none of which harmed the national security, I might add, and that came from the intelligence community. But one of the things that he did release was a video of American servicemen committing war crimes, clearly committing war crimes. So why weren't the perpetrators of the war crimes arrested? Why was Julian Assange arrested? Why are we arresting the messenger?
Unbelievable. Well, thank you so much. Definitely admire your courage. John Kiriakou, appreciate you being with us right here at Hidden Files. Well, according to Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador, in a recent statement, he says that the Statue of Liberty should be torn down if WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange is sentenced in the United States. Well, we're keeping our eyes on this case. Until next time, I'm Marzia Hashmi, and this is Hidden Files.
voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Biden administration asked a U.S. judge for a 60-day extension before it formally weighed in on whether Mohammed bin Salman, the Saudi crown prince, ought to be granted sovereign immunity in a case involving the murder of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi. The request comes after President Biden's return from a trip to Saudi Arabia and West Asia, in which he claims to have raised Khashoggi's murder with the Saudi crown prince. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Stephanie Kirchgassner. The piece is titled, White House Seeks to Delay Decision on Prince Mohammed Immunity Over Khashoggi Murder. The Biden administration asked the U.S. judge for a 60-day extension before it formally weighed in on whether Mohammed bin Salman, the Saudi crown prince, ought to be granted sovereign immunity in a case involving the murder of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi. The Department of Justice said in a filing before a U.S. district court that it had initiated a decision-making process about whether it would file a statement of interest in the case, but that it would not be able to comply with the court's requested deadline of 1st of August. The United States is diligently considering the court's inquiry, but the process for doing so requires consultation among multiple entities within the executive branch of the U.S. government with respect to complex issues of international and domestic law, the filing said. The judge in the case granted the U.S. government its request and gave it until 3rd of October to submit a statement of interest. The request comes just days after U.S. President Joe Biden returned from a controversial trip to Saudi Arabia, in which he met with Prince Mohammed bin Salman and claimed to have raised Jamal Khashoggi's murder in a private conversation with the crown prince. Jamal Khashoggi, a Saudi native who resided in Virginia, and wrote critically about the Saudi Crown Prince's crackdown on expression and dissent within the Saudi kingdom, was murdered by Saudi agents in the Saudi consulate building in Istanbul in October of 2018. An unclassified intelligence report into